you can hear it from the tones of the voices of the pilots, that this is in fact another day at the office. These pilots have evidently, and gunners have evidently, become so corrupted, morally corrupted by the war, that they are looking for excuses to kill.
So that's Julian Assange sitting in a Washington, D.C. studio right after he released the what they called collateral murder video. I later interviewed Julian in 2014 about WikiLeaks releasing the Iraq war logs. At the time, he was living inside the Ecuadorian embassy where he'd sought political asylum. We sat together there.
Iraq war logs, which were published in October 2010, which in some ways has been one of our best analytical works. We work together with not just other media organizations, but a number of statistical organizations to work out what the kill count was for Iraq, and combining with other figures, and we ended up with more than 100,000 civilian casualties, in fact, 15,000 new, completely undocumented civilian kills, and documenting U.S. involvement and approval of Iraqi torture centers within the police, and many killings of civilians at checkpoints and some political issues and so on. And that produced a number of inquiries and has fed into cases that have been taken by Iraqis that has now ended up with an ICC filing, an International Criminal Court filing, against the British military.
So that was one of several interviews I did with Julian Assange inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London when we traveled to interview him here there. That was in 2014. Well, in a moment, we'll be joined by Julian's father, John Shipton, and his brother, Gabriel Shipton. They're here in the U.S. for the opening of a new documentary about John Shipton's struggle to free his son. It's titled Ithaca. This is the film's trailer.
Julian Assange is the hero of our time.
He was the darling of the left.
All of a sudden, he's a puppet of Russia.
My name is John Shipton. I'm Julian Assange's father.
WikiLeaks found that Julian Assange has been arrested.
One of the most notorious and controversial figures in custody.
Assange will remain behind bars until that extradition hearing, which has been set down for the end of February.
The Department of Justice to drop the charges.
The maximum jail sentence of 175 years.
Because he published the truth.
How does it feel to be the father of such a controversial figure, somebody who's not known around the world?
Was that him on the phone before?
Yeah.
What are you talking about on a kind of regular basis?
If Julian is extradited to the United States to face these charges, he will be the first, but not the last.
What are your worst fears?
That it just collapses under the strain.
It looks as though what journalists do for a living is seen to be a criminal act.
Shipton, keep it up, man.
Thank you.
I wish I had your energy, I really do.
I'm done.
I'm
out.
Public love and support.
This is really truly a good question.
What's at stake? If he goes down, so will journalism.
That was the trailer for the new film Ithaca, produced by Julian Assange's brother, the filmmaker Gabriel Shipton, who joins us in Washington, D.C., along with their father, John Shipton. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Gabriel, let's begin with you. Talk about just the name of this film, Ithaca.
Well, it's named after a poem by C.P. Cavafee, and it's a poem that, John would listen to while we are, traveling around the world advocating for Julian. And it's sort of a really grounding, inspiring poem that talks about the journey and not the destination. And really, we chose the title because it's really about, when you're fighting for a cause bigger than yourself or for an unachievable or seemingly unachievable goal, you know, you have to live every day, or, you know, just take, put one foot in front of the other. And that's what really Ithaca is about. It's about the friends you make along the way, the lessons you learn, the things you see that keep you going every day in this fight to free Julian Assange.
And Gabriel, I mean, you were a filmmaker already, and then this hits your family. Can you give us the latest, what this hitting your family is, what has happened to Julian, and the latest state of affairs? He's been now at the Belmarsh prison for 4 years.
That's right. So it's coming. April 11th will be the 4 years in Belmarsh maximum security prison. He has one final appeal, application to appeal in with the High Court in the UK. He actually, all the papers and all the documents were submitted 5 months ago, and the High Court is still deliberating on whether to hear this appeal or not. So this is just further evidence that it's this thin veil, this thin legal veil that is hanging in front of Julian's persecution. He remains in a maximum security prison. He is not convicted of any crime. He's held there solely at the request of the US DOJ. The prison has 800 inmates, 20% of whom are convicted murderers. Julian shares a cell block with these people. He spends most of his days isolated in his cell. It really is a dire situation for Julian. And I really just have to compel people that, you know, we have to act to free him now.
I want to turn to a clip from Ithaca, where our guest John Shipton, Julian's dad, talks about visiting him at the Belmarsh prison for the first time.
Can we talk about the day Julian asked you to help? Can you talk me through that?
I don't really remember. What I remember is that he got arrested, and so I came here and went and saw him in the, went and saw Julian in the jail. Anyway, he was in a very bad way.
Okay. Yeah, just tell me, how was Julian's son?
He's lost about 10 kilos weight, and he's psychologically under a lot of stress and pressure. The visiting hours are very, very precious. Sorry, I'm a bit upset.
Is this
your first? Yes, my first, yes.
Were you able to give him a hug?
Yes, yes, that, yeah, yeah.
How was that moving?
It's pretty moving, as you would expect. Pretty tough for him. I guess that'll do.
Thank you very much.
So I said, I'll be back. I won't stop coming until you can come home.
So that's John Shipton just outside of Belmarsh after seeing Julian inside for the first time. John Shipton joining us from Washington, D.C., just before he heads up here to New York with Gabriel for the film showings in various theaters around the U.S. We'll be there tonight. I'll be doing the Q&A with John and Gabriel. John, talk about that moment, seeing your son, what this means to you, and having a film about your decision to travel the world to garner support for Julian Assange.
Good morning, Penny. Well, you know, it's a bit heartrending. When I went in and saw Julian, he was a bit, you know, wobbly. He just was still in what the prisoners call the hell wing, which the prison governor calls the health wing. It's a pod within the prison where the prison isolates those it considers ill. Julian was considered so depressed that he had to be watched 24 hours a day to prevent any self-harm. And he'd lost a lot of weight. Usually, you know, Julian is a very strong-minded man. And he never asks me for anything, but he, at that stage, just asked, could I come and give a hand for, could I come and work at, getting him free from those circumstances? And that was about 3.5 years ago. So that's the circumstances. Actually, it'll be 4 years in April. Since then, we've built a worldwide movement. Every single parliament in the Western Theatre has a cross-party Assange group. The United Nations have involved themselves. The Council of Europe have involved themselves. And every single major civic organisation in the United States, ACLU, Asylum, Human Rights Watch, 27 of them in all, have involved themselves in the five great newspaper outlets that partnered with Julian in the release of the Iraq war files, the cables and the Afghanistan war files. They have written a letter to Merrick Garland asking that the charges be dropped. Of course, the publishers have written this letter. As Julian is a publisher, all publishers realise that this prosecution has brought a chill to the capacity to analyse policy and a capacity to print that analysis, so thereby to inform the public.
Newspapers that have called for his release, New York Times, The Guardian, El País, Der Spiegel. But I'd like to go back to a 2010 Meet the Press interview with then-Vice President Joe Biden. ABC host at the time, David Gregory, questioned Biden about Assange.
Should the United States do something to stop Mr. Assange?
We're looking at that right now. The Justice Department is taking a look at that, and I'm not going to comment on that process.
You think he is a criminal?
If he conspired to get these classified documents with a member of the U.S. military, that's fundamentally different than if somebody drops on your lap, here, David, you're a press person, here is classified material.
Mitch McConnell says he's a high-tech terrorist. Others say this is akin to the Pentagon Papers. Where do you come from?
I would argue that it's closer to being a high-tech terrorist.
A high-tech terrorist, Gabriel Shifton. That's now President Biden. He said that as vice president on NBC Meet the Press. That seems to be a comment across the political spectrum, from Biden to the former director of the CIA, Pompeo, who could be running for president. Your response and what sense you're getting from inside the Biden administration right now on this extradition request?
Well, this was, you know, an extradition prosecution that was pushed by, as you say, Mike Pompeo and the Trump administration. And now, under the Biden administration, it continues on. So, you know, the Biden administration is owning this this prosecution at the moment, and they're continuing pushing forward with it. The National Security DOJ, is fighting Julian's application to appeal, and so we see that they're pushing forward with this prosecution. What we are seeing, though, and what John was talking about, is this worldwide movement for freedom of expression that has grown up around the fight to free Julian. And that is now coming into the Congress in the United States. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib has a Dear Colleagues letter that's coming from the Progressive Caucus. We know there are four other congresspeople signed on from the Progressive Caucus. So we're really seeing some movement in Congress from the Democratic side, as well as Republicans like Thomas Massie, who have been longtime supporters of Julian. So we are hopeful that this sort of pressure will help the Justice Department, help Merrick Garland really have a look at this Trump-era prosecution that criminalizes what journalists should be doing every day, publishing without fear or favor. They need to have another look at it and really come to the conclusion that the New York Times has, that the ACLU has, that this is a threat to press freedom and the First Amendment.
And finally, John Shipton, you're Julian's dad. Does he and Belmarsh hold out hope?
Sorry, I missed the
do
question.
Do you hold out hope for his freedom?
Yes, most certainly. I use the word faith, you know, every second, every minute devoted to continuing. It benefits, first of all, Julian, and secondly, our family. Thirdly, all of those people who believe in the great artifact of the United States Constitution, the First Amendment, whereby we can freely read, freely comment, and as a consequence of that, build an understanding of government policy or cultural or social movements. It's just absolutely vital. And it was first discovered or first announced by Goodall, who was the first announced by Goodall as a global problem. Goodall was the attorney who fought on behalf of the New York Times back in the Pentagon Papers day. Also, I would add that the support of Daniel Ellsberg has been, you know, stalwart over the last 14 years. And he, last time we was here, he invited us into his house. And it's with considerable sadness that Gabriel and I received a note from Daniel the other day that he would be leaving us soon.
Meaning he's announced that he has pancreatic cancer and doctors have said he has months to live. John Shipton, I want to thank you so much for being with us, father of Julian Assange. I also want to thank Gabriel. Gabriel Shipton, Julian's brother, who is the producer of the new documentary Ithaca, which was written and directed by Ben Lawrence. Ithaca will be screening in New York tonight at the New Plaza Cinema on 67th Street in the Upper West Side, where I'll be doing a Q&A with John and Gabriel after the film. On Saturday, it'll be screening at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, Long Island, on Sunday at the Picture House in Bronxville, and on Monday at the Alamo Draft House in New York City. You can go to democracynow.org for details. Coming up, we continue to look at the costs of the Iraq war, from civilian casualties to soaring Pentagon budgets. Stay with us.
Oh, my mama, she gave me these feather breaths. Oh, my mama, she told me, use your voice. Little bird, she said, sing, 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 sing melodies. And she sang, 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 sang melodies. Oh, my mama, she did give me fancy feet on.
By Leila Diane. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to mark the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq, we look now at the many costs of the war, from civilian casualties to soaring Pentagon budgets, with Nita Crawford, co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University. She's author of a new report titled Blood and Treasure, United States Budgetary Costs and Human Costs of 20 Years of War in Iraq and Syria, 2003 to 2023. She's also professor of international relations at Oxford University and author of the new book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions. Today, she's joining us from Montreal, Canada. Nita, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can start off by laying out what you found as you looked at 20 years of U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, and I say going right through today because thousands of U.S. soldiers are still in Iraq.
That's right. So in 2002, the United States had a discussion about the costs of a possible war in Iraq and the possibility of civilians and others being harmed. And the estimates were then quite low, between $50 billion and $200 billion or $300 billion would be the total cost of war. There'd be few civilian casualties, few military casualties, and that the war would be contained and over very quickly. And what has happened over the last 20 years is that thousands of U.S. service members were killed, about 5,000 U.S. service members and many contractors. And then, in addition, hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed, 7,000 by the U.S. in the first month of the war, but now hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed by all parties over the 20 years. And that's in part because Iraq descended into civil war shortly after the U.S. invasion. And then, in addition, many millions of people were displaced. Millions of people are still displaced internally and also as refugees in the region. Now, in Syria, there when the U.S. intervened in 2014 into an ongoing Syrian civil war, many more people were displaced, many more people were injured by bombs. And then what we also see is that even in the places where the fighting has stopped, civilians and other people, like healthcare workers, have been injured by unexploded ordnance, which has been left in the wake of the war. So the story continues. It's not over. It wasn't quick. It wasn't easy. And it certainly wasn't cost-free.
So I want to ask you about the costs of war right now as we look at your report, which includes a table that shows more than 2,000 civilians were killed by U.S. coalition airstrikes in the first month of the Iraq war alone. Again, the U.S. invaded Iraq 20 years ago Sunday, our time Sunday. It was the 20th, March 20th in Iraq, March 19th in the United States.
That's right. The U.S. began airstrikes actually before the war began in a small number, but in the first month of the war, about 7,000 civilians were killed by all means by the U.S. coalition, more than 2,000 of them killed by airstrikes. And this was part of what was called then the shock and awe strategy. The idea was that if the United States bombarded Iraq, hit vital infrastructure and leaders, that the Iraqi military would collapse, that they would surrender. And, of course, that didn't happen. But there were many civilians killed inadvertently by air strikes that went astray. And this is always the case in war, that civilians are harmed unintentionally. And then, of course, the airstrikes continued. But the first war was in particular quite intense. The first month of the war was in particular quite intense.
So 2,500 U.S. soldiers are still in Iraq. If you can talk more about what the U.S. Is even requesting now. I mean, we're talking about the U.S. returning to significant military operations in Iraq and Syria in late 2014 and fighting that was undertaken, they said, to remove Islamic State from the territory. The war continues with a nearly $400 million budget request from the Biden administration this month to counter ISIS, they say.
That's right. The United States believes that if they leave, ISIS or some other militants will come back. And right now, the idea is to maintain a presence there on the border and also in Syria to make sure that ISIS cannot recover and take more territory. Now, of course, in the period after the invasion, there were no militants, terrorists in Iraq. And that's what we knew then, that the reason for the war in 2003 was to supposedly get rid of weapons of mass destruction, which were not there and never found, of course, because they had already been dismantled. But ISIS and other militants flocked to Iraq in part to push back the United States coalition and to try to free Iraq from what they saw as a foreign occupation. And so the birth of ISIS is in part due to the U.S. invasion in 2003. And of course, ISIS spread in the region and took over large swaths of territory, which then had to be retaken. And it was a very intense fight. So the United States remains there to do that at, as you say, a requested nearly $400 million for next year.
Professor Crawford, why did you include Syria in the costs of war with Iraq?
Well, quite simply because when ISIS took this territory, they didn't take it just in Syria, they took it in Iraq. The reason why President Obama said the United States needed to be in this fight was because the democracy that the United States hoped to set up and support in Iraq, the government there was at risk. Large parts of the territory near Syria were taken. So the United States began bombardment of ISIS, and so did other countries, and tried to take that territory back. Of course, they destroyed much of what had been rebuilt following the 2003 invasion. And this is why it's included, because it's of a piece. The entire war effort is premised on fighting, post-2014 is premised on fighting ISIS, which was in both countries. And that's, it's called Operation Inherent Resolve, and that's the point. It is about Syria and Iraq.
And finally, your new book, The Pentagon Climate Change and War, charting the rise and fall of U.S. military emissions related directly to Iraq.
No, well, the rise and fall of U.S. military emissions, The Pentagon Climate Change and War, is about U.S. Military emissions from the 19th century to the present. But the part of the emissions from the Iraq war, I calculate to be about 100 million metric tons from 2003 to the present.
Right. And we have 15 seconds, but the connection between climate change and a war for oil.
Well, it takes fuel to fight, and the fight for fuel has been a large part of United States military doctrine and U.S. foreign policy since the 1980s. The idea is to make sure that the fuel is available, and in part, it's so that it's available for warfare.
Professor Crawford, we're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Nita Crawford, professor of international relations at Oxford University, co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University, will link to your new report, Blood and Treasure. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Looking for a community who will support you on your academic journey? The Student Learning Commons has got your back. The Student Learning Commons is SFU's Academic Success Center. We provide free workshops, one-on-one consultations, coaching, and online tutoring with a focus on writing, study skills, and academic English. All Student Learning Commons programs and services are available to SFU students and are approved by SFU as providing ethical, academically honest support. Learn more by visiting our locations in the library on all three SFU campuses, or check us out online at learningcommons.sfu.ca.
You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.